My name is Jeffrey Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is a special edition for Creative Times Summit, Revolutions in Public Practice. We're doing this for the Huffington Post, and my special guest in the green room, which is yellow and is serving Cheetos for free, is Liam Gillick. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Tell us a little bit about why in the hell you're here.
Well, I think I'm here partly because I'm interested in speaking in public. And therefore, I think, you know, to a certain extent, they had looked for people who are quite happy to stand up there and account for themselves. And I think this is something to be acknowledged because, of course, a lot of the work that's being discussed by the contributors today are not here. You know, they're either people who become the subjects of the work or they're the people who've participated in work. But what we've got here really today is a kind of collection of the people who have either instigated projects or trying to account for projects or trying to report in a way on a fairly basic level about what they've done. Some people are just bringing information. That's quite interesting. I, on the other hand, am not bringing stories about work, really. And I'm trying to address more of a series of abstractions in a way. And that's going to be interesting up to a point, but won't have the same functional quality that some of the other things have had.
Are you nervous about the limited time span?
Yes, because I'm someone who really emerged believing in this idea of what you call discourse as a way of originating work rather than sort of sitting alone at home trying to work out what to do next. That things would come and develop through group work and talking about ideas and in a way the exhibition itself would become the space of work. It would become the moment when ideas start to come together, that the work wouldn't happen in advance of a public event or a moment of it coming into public view. So what's quite, it's an interesting idea to do this 7-minute thing, but of course it has, the downside of it is it can feel a little bit too much like other structures in the world, which are also limited. You know, like if you go to a certain kind of technology conferences or certain kind of software conferences where people make their 7-minute presentation, it's got that compressing of time. While it's very good in terms of getting to see people's faces and put a face to work and hear what's been going on, it has this limiting aspect that's a little tricky. But I think it's worth experimenting with, and it's usually the other way around, frankly. I mean, usually things are so drawn out and so tedious that actually this is reasonably refreshing, frankly. My problem, as you can tell, is I can't shut up, so it's going to be interesting to work out whether I can actually even get going in 7 minutes.
Are you going to talk over the instrument that comes over you?
Well, since I got here and I realized that it really was instruments rather than noise, if you see what I mean, I'm finding it sometimes quite beautiful when people are speaking and the music starts. So, you know, with Maria Lynn's presentation, I nearly, you know, found it even quite emotional somehow. So I've been thinking of rewriting my last couple of lines to really kind of go for impact, emotional impact, and see if I can get a tear or two. But I'm stuck with what I've got. It doesn't really work that way.
I mean, yeah, like Suzanne Lacy was talking about, you know, like the Oakland police, you know, literally like shooting young teenagers. And then there was this beautiful kind of like folk new age guitar over the top of it. That was so surreal.
Yeah, that's when the credits should roll, you know. And so I'm seeing it definitely more in semi-Altman-esque terms where, you know, rather than everyone talking over each other at the same time, they're all talking one after the other. But there are these sort of incidental moments, like credits roll every 7 minutes. And I quite like that. I quite like looking at it as a kind of TV series or a series of episodes rather than a conference. And I'm looking forward to the music each time. That's what I want to hear.
I came for the talk but stayed for the music.
Yes, exactly.
So tell us a little bit about what you're going to tackle tonight.
Well, you know, I was given a theme, as it were. So I was given there's a title that sort of embraces the section that I'm addressing, but that's not something that's coming from me. That's coming from NATO, and it's coming from Creative Time. And I think you've got to understand that it is quite a designated event, meaning that they've come up with these topics and areas and then invited people to address them. And my one, the one I was given was something like ambiguity is my political doodah or whatever it is. And I guess it's because I do like to operate within, I operate within a contemporary art context quite often, and I am remain interested in the potential of at least the legacy of a kind of autonomous art, or the idea that it might be possible to somehow, you know, keep the concrete cube of autonomy sort of afloat in some swimming pool of whatever. And I guess that's what the, in a way, it's, I've taken it quite personally as almost an accusation, like the idea of ambiguity is my political weapon, you know, it seems to be a kind of paradox. So initially, like a lot of these things, and in the tradition of people addressing a theme, I decided I'd completely deny having anything to do with such an idea. And then I realized that actually maybe I would turn back to the subject and really try and address it. So I'm trying to do that through thinking about the workplace, which has been one of my ongoing interests in the last 5 years, and the idea of what happened to the legacy of like progressive working practice, and how that affected how artists function and how art is produced. And you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about
this.
Yeah.
Progressive working practice.
Yes.
For those not familiar.
Well, you could call them, say, for example, the idea of the relationship between like neo-Tayloristic and anti-Tayloristic working practice, which would mean different versions of new post-production line activity, especially the kind of thing that was pioneered by people like Volvo in the 70s and 60s in Europe, which then became standard, right? So, which became standard. So you have, on the one hand, neo-Tayloristic practice tends to involve like more efficiency of production. It involves teamwork, but only teamwork towards the idea of, you know, a kind of just-in-time idea and a sort of more efficient kind of way of working, rather than on the production line, but through kind of teamwork. Anti-Tayloristic working tends to be more like the original Volvo model, where you designate a group of people and they can come up with their own working systems, and they don't have a spokesman and they don't have a leader, but they work together and they negotiate their working day and they come up with new models of practice that way. And I wanted to look at the way these things can be maybe analogous to the way ideas and art gets done and gets produced. I'm not really doing the same thing as other people who are reporting back on what they've done and how that might affect the community or society with its failings and its potentials. I'm really looking at the models of practice that might have informed the desire to do that in the first place, and whether you can make some kind of analogies across to organized work and the history of organized work. It sounds a little, what would you say, a little indirect, and I think that's probably this subject of ambiguity, I think, yeah, maybe another way of putting it is more that it's indirect. I'm not interested in mirroring as much as certain people are. I think it's very necessary, but I'm not so interested in art that creates a mirror of the dominant culture's failings as a kind of imposed guardian of people's lives. So I'm much more interested in the problems of like the artistic condition or the artistic production, you know, and not just assuming that the artist would be good or the artist is an acceptable mediator or an artist working in a group is necessarily good or working alone is necessarily bad. So, you know, I try and get some of that out in 7 minutes and see what happens.
Well, that's a hell of a task. Similar to that, I was at an anarchist meeting a few nights ago.
They have meetings?
They do have meetings. It was insane.
They just sort of spontaneously came together.
The meeting came down to an argument between two people, mm-hmm. one a presenter and one a questioner from the audience, mm-hmm. you know, a dissenter, you know, surprise at an anarchist mm-hmm. meeting. And the presenter had talked about anarchism working with a capitalistic model. That mm-hmm. you can have anarchistic ideas, but still use a capitalistic model to support those ideas. And then, of course, the person in the audience saying you're missing the entire boat, mm-hmm. that the entire reason, you know, you're thinking that is just you're playing into the system and things like that. Do you consider it like a same battle that way? That, you know, people presenting today are just kind of falling into idea roles that they have no concept about?
No, I think the ideas and the the work being talked about isn't all the same, and that's why I'm trying to use my analogy of these different workplace models to try and find what these differences are. But, I don't doubt for a second the sincerity of good social work done by artists. The only thing that we can say about it is that it's more likely to get instrumentalized than some other art. So it has its own problems. So if we can say that at one extreme we have, increasing subjectivity in art, meaning, a focus on extreme differences and very individual practices that all kind of make up this big contemporary art sort of field, right? And on the other hand, you have this kind of rather precise, more precise sort of social work. If the subjective side has the dangers of being commodified and being taken over and being used up and being turned into the banal somehow, the other one has the problem of potentially being instrumentalized. And this isn't such a developed issue in the US. So in fact, you could say that some of the more activist practices in the US have a kind of urgent necessity. When you turn to the ones that are really coming from Europe, this gets much more problematic, because the history of social democracy in Europe lends itself towards funding, for example, state funding for art, which now requires a social.
Sorry, there's a momentary break for fascism.
Yeah, what you find is that increasingly, and Maria Lin's written a small book about this. Increasingly, cultural funding in Europe and probably will happen more and more here has a requirement for a kind of accounting for its social goodness, right? So on one hand, I would obviously support many of the projects, and I mean you'd have to be pretty hard-hearted to not think that these things must be pointing out something profound. But we do have this kind of situation where the base of the work isn't the same, that there are fundamental differences between European funding, American funding, how that these things work out. And I'm really looking, as a viewer, and listening out for these differences, really. And I'm really using it. I'm listening to it as a kind of someone who's a specialist or knowledgeable in a field of work, and I'm trying to play with these differences in my head and think about what they imply. And think about rather than the idea of compromise or the fact that people are really operating within a capitalist system, more the idea of where do you draw the line, and when do you really quit the art context and you claim that you're no longer involved and you actually move into something that's much more clearly recognizable as pure activism in a profound, urgent, and of course always dangerous way. Frankly, if you say I'm involved in an art project, you can often diffuse quite a tense situation when you're involved in a just did yesterday.
Yes, in fact, with the NYPD.
Yes, exactly, and it at least creates if it doesn't immediately, it won't stop you getting arrested, it won't stop people getting their stuff taken away. It at least can create a space of doubt for a while, and that's the way I view it often with people. I think people are deploying or using the art context in order to occasionally create a space of doubt within which they might be able to continue climbing up the side of the building or undermining letting down the tires of the cars under the umbrella of art. And I find this extremely interesting, but I'm not so worried about what we could call the sort of the hypocrisy quota or something like, or whatever you'd call it, the hypocrisy equation. I'm not really trying to sit there and calculate the hypocrisy equation for every single project, because we have to say that whether you were interested in it or not, right, that one thing you can be sure about is that the two battlegrounds of contemporary art at the moment within the Western or developed context, whatever we could call it, are on one hand super subjectivity, on the other a kind of documentary practice. And these are the two extremes that we're dealing with. And here we're just witnessing more of one extreme than the other. But they actually both derive in some ways from developments in thinking about the potential of art that happened in the post-war period and became increasingly refined during the 70s. They've both become rather kind of cartoonized versions of what they're supposed to represent. One acknowledges difference to the extent where things start to become a kind of relativist soup of you know, unicorns and planets and like just falling over. And the other one is can often be heading towards the point where it's almost just showing back to the person who just, you know, wrecked the potential of society, what they just did, which is, of course, in itself a slightly tautological act. So I'm somehow caught, not in the middle ground exactly, but I'm involved in a rather different sense in a more structural thinking about these things, about the function of an artist in relation to what could be thought of as political. But it requires, for me to have any function at all, I need these extremes in both directions. Do you see what I mean? That I require them. If they didn't exist, or if one took over from the other, I would have to change. I would have to make a different kind of work.
Now, tell me what you think about this, okay? I have an older friend, and when I say older, I'd say he's probably, you know, late 60s, painter, mm-hmm. And he says that the trajectory of most artists, and, you know, he's an old set in his ways man, okay? So this is an old man theory, you know? Uh-huh. But he says that artists go from making work, you know, the self-referential work that you were talking about, the subjective work, early in life, to by the end of life, they're just making documentations of things they've seen. That's the trajectory that he's seen in his mm-hmm. life. Would you agree with that?
It may be true if you were a painter of a certain age, so you might well think like that. I think what I did very early on is I was very conscious that you could see this process happen in art school. So I decided instead of doing it, because I didn't, as a suburban sort of deluded and distracted person, I didn't have any, you know, I was sort of, I had it up to my ears with people agonizing over their distracted and deluded nature, that I thought, well, I'll make myself the constant in the work, actually. And then I'll be free of this sort of second mirror phase of development where you go through art school and you begin this process of self-examination, which becomes self-realization, which becomes the confidence to address the world and reflect the world. And I would sort of, a bit like the tin drum, I could stay at this state of perfect, like, late teenage enlightenment, you know, when you're the cleverest that you'll ever be, because I would be the unique, I would be the continual and the...
You're the control.
I'm like, yeah, I am the... Yeah, it's more like I am the consistent factor in the work. So the work itself is then free to be many different things because I can address all sorts of things. And it's true, I recognize what your friend described, but I also tried to avoid it.
And do you think you've been successful?
Yes, up to now, I think it's surprising that it kind of works. I think making some kind of decision very early on, which is not necessarily about I'm going to paint doors or I'm going to make videos of buildings, but actually a structural, a decision about how to approach the idea of being an artist is actually quite, I found extremely productive. And it was partly came from thinking about people who'd done something similar, but, you know, that I was always a bit jealous of because it sounded so much better. Like Marcel Brutes, you know, who had been a poet, which is already something more than, you know, it's already quite something, you know, apparently, supposedly, or he did say, you know, one day I woke up and decided to make something of myself and I became an artist. And I thought, well, that's a dopey thing to be doing, you know, 25 years later. But there might be an equivalent way of this decision, this active decision that could be appropriate to my time. And that was that was very important, I think.
Now, on the flip side of that, though, one of my, you know, role models, Duchamp, mm-hmm. took the opposite trajectory, and by the time, you know, is middle-aged, was like, you know, chess is actually where it's at, that art is really, doesn't call my name anymore, and that I'm going to do something with my life and play, you know, master a game.
No, I find it's a bit odd. It's a little bit like, sometimes when you're in a taxi and you're kind of stuck in traffic and you think, you know what, I'm going to get a taxi. That'll be quicker. And you can't. I mean, you're just stuck. There's no way out of the dilemma. And of course, I've realized that, I've been asking students recently, what is your hobby going to be when you are secure enough in your own mind or deluded or depressed, but functionally depressed enough to turn to something else, whether it's horse breeding. A lot of breeding going on with artists, like horse breeding, dog breeding, this kind of thing, or classic cars or whatever it might be. And I'm curious I'm always curious to ask very young people what they think, if they had projected into the future, what they imagine would be the thing that they would do, which is play, what is the playing chess of their work? What does their work point towards as an activity?
And of course, I have to ask you, what did you think it would be when you were 18? Mm-hmm. And B, what is it now?
I thought that, I had a much more desperate model of thinking about these things, because I thought that having no ideas and no vision, that the only way I could even function in an art world was to actually just not stop. And if I didn't stop, then somehow things would happen. I don't mean things in terms of a career, but I just mean things. Like, you would start to have ideas, you would have a context, you would have a way of working. So actually what's happened is that my entire existence is based on a suppression of the question, what would you do? What is your game of chess? So of course, not being any good at chess, I did actually think at one point it might be backgammon, which is a kind of idiot chess, but it looks kind of sophisticated in a chessy sort of way.
Checkers?
Yeah, checkers looks too dumb. But backgammon's sort of like sexy checkers. And and I tried it, but it's just too boring after a while. It doesn't sustain.
Dominoes?
Nah, no good. I don't know.
And so today, now that you have some years behind you, you're away from 18. Mm-hmm. What do you fill the idle moments with?
Well, there are no idle moments. There aren't any, because I work neurotically, in a way. So there are no idle moments, basically.
Your idle moments are filled with asking other people what their idle moments are.
Yeah, exactly. They're things like this. My idle moments are standing on a stage talking to people, which sounds very glib and narcissistic, but it's actually a genuine answer. I mean, this is an idle moment, I can relax and sit on the carpet and listen to people speak. But, I suffer from all of the typical anxieties of the undereducated and those who are, don't come from a high-class background, that I feel I need to be listening, and I need to be reading, and I need to be paying attention. I've got a lot of catching up to do.
And so I ask you, in that context, what do you consider to be your greatest mistake that you've made?
Maybe to underestimate the extent to which the worrying about whether or not it'll be possible to function as an artist is the big problem. Like, you think at the beginning, well, the big struggle you're going to have is how to find a space to work, how to work, how to find a subject, how to find a context. And actually, I think at this point, I realize that it's, I don't know the right way of putting it. The harder thing to work on is a sort of critical position and sustaining collective practices, sustaining meaningful collectivity in a way. This is really hard, and I think I slightly underestimate it, because the system to a certain extent works towards a kind of artisting. It sounds stupid and pretentious, but meaning that everything within the system, if you enter it at all, works towards defining you as an artist, including this event, right? It's just another redefinition of you as an artist and a reassertion of you as an artist. And I think that, the harder things are the things that they're hard for a reason. So they're the things I kind of often regret, or I often worry about, you know, or think that something got missed. Something like that. But, on the other hand, I think that I sometimes, you know, I think about what I did this year, and I did the German Pavilion, and I did a building in Guadalajara with a young architect called Rodrigo Gomez Villaseñor.
Now, for those listening, to quickly elaborate, the German Pavilion is the German Pavilion at the Venice Biennale,
yes,
which is the largest kind of art, or function in the world.
Yes. So when you're thinking back to sort of being an 18-year-old, if I found out that at this point I had done this year a large building in Guadalajara in Mexico and represented Germany at the Venice Biennale, I'd be really happy. But I'd want to know what had gone on, what the hell had been happening in the previous 20 years. And this, to me, is a kind of, not a success, but this is a functional reflection of what I was interested in the beginning by making myself the consistent factor of the work. On the other hand, of course, that the sort of the problem with that, I don't know if it's a real problem, but that also brings with it, new anxieties, the feeling that that somehow you become a subject rather than a, you know, I think right now the big problem is trying to somehow occasionally step out or step sideways and work in a more, not subtle way, but work in a way that's not maybe so visible somehow. I don't know.
Now I'm going to ask you the question that I've been meaning to ask for what, 6 months now almost? Four or five months. The cat. Tell me about the cat.
Well, the cat is a stuffed cat that sat in the German Pavilion on a kind of schematic kitchen that I designed. And in that show, in the show in Venice, I really did something very simple, if you think about it as an analogy to a writer or a filmmaker or something. I basically shifted my normal order of representation. So say that you normally write in the third person, I write in the first person, or say you normally film, in black and white, I filmed in color. So I basically shifted, I made the more abstract, formalist aspects of my work more representational. I made the text aspects of my work more first person spoken. So the cat ended up, you know, I needed a character in this building to discuss or to talk about the idea of not just this self-referential thing, the idea of being a building, but I wanted a commentator. The work was taking place in a building from the Third Reich period. It's an entirely 100% Nazi building from top to toe. And I needed to function in this place in a way that could still allow for a kind of commentary, that everything would somehow could be talked about. And ended up, you know, I was a big fan of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which is one of the great American dramas, drama comedies of all time, alongside Saved by the Bell. And I really was thinking about the cat, the smart-ass cat in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. And I thought, you know, I liked this idea that you could use a character who somehow had seen everything, had been there. You know, the cat is often the last thing around in the rubbles, in the rubble of the destroyed city. It's seen Dresden burn, and it's picked through the, the rubble of Berlin, but it's also been in Srebrenica, and it's somehow the cat survives. And just as you're, and maybe the last thing you feel as you lie there with your legs blown off is a cat rubbing itself against your arm or something, this strange kind of desire for affection. So the cat was a kind of analog for me in a way, like they're promiscuous, they're turning up when you don't necessarily want them, they're rubbing up against you trying to get some attention. But also the cat could be a spokesperson for all cats, and therefore it could somehow talk about some of the ideologies that have taken place around Germany but also post-war Europe as a whole without being national, like it could be like pan-national in a way. And in the end, the cat ended up telling a story. The cat ended up telling a story about two kids coming one day to a building in a park in Venice, to come and see a cat that can speak. So basically, you have this cat that can speak, and basically, a conversation develops between these two kids and this cat, and it allowed me to. I thought it was all going really well. It allowed me to talk about these various ideas. But the day before the opening, I had this stupid animated cat, like animatronic cat, just like in Sabrina the Teenage Witch. But unlike that my thing was an exhibition in a German pavilion and not a TV show. So it didn't quite have the light-hearted and yet profound qualities that I wanted it to have. So I picked up one of the information sheets about what was going on that carried the text in written form and jammed it in the cat's mouth, which jammed the mechanism, and was sort of the last gesture before the opening. So you can still hear the voice, but you can't see the lips move, which I always thought must be a sort of J.J. Hudsucker, whatever it's called, you know, like the sweet smell of success type statement. I didn't know what it would mean, but I thought it felt good, right? You can still hear the words, but you can't see the lips move. It sounded like the kind of thing someone might say that had some great wisdom about it. And in a way, it was a gesture of failure and a gesture of acknowledging that I really was kind of defeated by this whole environment. But that wasn't going to stop me doing something. And I think people often forget this about artists. They often think that what artists show is what they want to show. And of course, we know that sometimes that what artists do is actually, they're often the first to compromise, they're often the first to, or they're often functioning in the complete inverse of the way of the popular imagination of an artist. And in that case, you know, I definitely failed, but it was a failure that I was determined to go through with.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was nice.
My name is Zephyr Thrall. You're listening to Frank Prattle. This is a special edition for Creative Time at their insane summit, Revolutions in Public Revolutions. And my special guest has been Liam Gellick, an artist and orator, we'll say, a storyteller, a cat fancier, and we've been backstage. Thanks so much.
Thank you.